This is David Rovix, and you are tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., Melbourne, Australia. Step 3 is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
Welcome to the Climate Action Radio Show, which can be heard on community radio at 3CR in Melbourne and Skid Row in Sydney. My name is Vivian Langford, and salut Babette. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and pay tribute to the decades-long legacy of Aboriginal fights for land rights and against the destructive mining projects that are fueling climate change. In particular, we acknowledge the Wangan and Jagalingu cultural custodians and their ongoing opposition to coal mining on their lands in central Queensland, and to the Gomeroi traditional custodians' continuing opposition to coal and gas on their land in New South Wales. It is vital at this late stage in history that we all learn to care for country. It will always be Aboriginal land, and now is our time to all stand up for and protect it.
The world saw Sydney Harbour Bridge crammed with over 100,000 people last week, some said 200 or even 300,000, marching behind a banner for humanity. One of the chants was, "We are all Palestinians." People were expressing their desire for the starvation and cruelty in Palestine to stop, for the world community to get a grip. It was a palpable shift as members of the governing Labour Party joined with the community leaders in the sobbing rain. Today's show is about thinking even bigger than humanity. It's about what Joanna Macy calls the great turning. And the banner might be, "We are all nature." We'll hear a tribute to Joanna Macy from famous Australian deep ecologist John Seed and from the late Joanna Macy herself. After that, Dr. Peter Sainsbury pays tribute to Sebastia Salgado and also to our Ken Henry, both of them thought leaders in the great turning to a more life-affirming culture. He covers marine heatwaves, global water security, plus Mataranka Springs, and lots more. Here's John Seed. Joanna Macy died last week. She was a great leader among climate activists, both for books like Active Hope and her workshops, drawing on systems thinking and Buddhist teaching. John Seed, who has the Order of Australia for his deep ecology work, knew Joanna and is here to speak in memory of her. Welcome, John.
Thanks so much, Vivian.
And tell us about Joanna, your memory of her.
Oh, well, I met Joanna in 1985 when she visited Australia, and it was, you know, one of the great turning points of my life that I had been professing the philosophy of deep ecology for some years, but Arnie Ness, the professor of philosophy from Oslo University who coined the term deep ecology, as he pointed out, the ideas are of no use that unless we have ecological identity, ecological self, merely having ecological ideas won't help us. And so it was finally when I met Joanna that the missing piece fell into place, and the incredible I would have to say spiritual technology that she represented for how to create the conditions for immense personal and social change. And through our meeting, the work that reconnects experiential deep ecology workshops came into being.
Yeah, well, thousands and thousands of people will know her through her workshops and her books. And she wanted us to look unflinchingly. She used that word quite a bit at the ecological crisis we've created. How did she teach us about staying alive to the world, you know, staying brave in a way?
Well, I think what she represented was a total confidence that all of the feelings that we have been taught to fear, that we can create a safe container that will welcome those feelings, and that there's nothing to fear whatsoever, but that there is immense rewards for us both personally and socially from liberating those banished feelings. So she was talking about anguish and rage and terror, and that she showed us how to welcome the intelligence that those feelings bring into our lives without being harmed in any way.
Yes. Well, a lot of one of her teachings, I've just been rereading her Active Hope book, and she talks a bit about how we often block our survival response. And climate action people know that it's survival we want and keep our humanity intact and broaden it. But she used the example of, that a well-known experiment where there's a room and a person goes in and everyone else is filling in a questionnaire and he comes in and there's smoke starts coming in and he doesn't move because everyone else is doing their questionnaire, and then more smoke comes in, and he just follows the herd. If he was on his own, he'd be running out and calling Triple O. That I think has happened to us in many domains, and most recently I've noticed this Harbour Bridge walk. For Sydney people, this massive demonstration of support for humanity. Appalling, being people appalled by what's happening in the Middle East has got out of control, really, and. That breaking of ranks seems to me like a breakthrough of that person breaking out of the room and saying there's smoke in there, call Triple O. And in climate, the same. Tell us a bit about Joanna's thoughts about that systems thinking and how we act like a herd until we get the idea, no, break ranks and take
Yeah,
action.
well, I mean, one of the things that that she understood that by taking a long view and seeing ourselves through deep time, that every single cell in our bodies is descended in an unbroken chain from the first cell of life on Earth. And during that entire 4,000 million years, we can be utterly confident that every single one of our ancestors was intelligent enough to reach the age of reproducing itself before it was consumed, without exception. And 99.99999% of that intelligence preceded cognition. So the feelings that are being suppressed are what remains in us of this ancient intelligence that unerringly allowed our ancestors in every single generation to make good decisions about what was dangerous and what was safe, when to flee and when to stand and fight, and all of these kind of things. So that as we suppress these feelings, we suppress this. It's the part of our intelligence that moves us. So the cognition is important as well, of course, but in the absence of the passion that's supposed to accompany the thoughts, the cognition is sterile. That although we know what we need to do, which is to escape the burning room, we're trapped, we're paralyzed, we feel helpless, we feel hopeless, we feel, oh, what can one person do anyway? It's all too late. All of these things flood into us. And so Joanna taught us how to welcome those feelings and to welcome the incredible passion that they bring into our lives that allow us to stand up and fight.
Yes. Well, you're the veteran of many campaigns. I know you've been on 3CR quite a few times talking about the forestry campaigns. And I try to do on the climate show interview people who are like you who have just done it, just done things, and in connection with other people and have been enriched. Some of them have been in jail as well and persecuted and frightened by the response they get by sticking out and standing out. But mostly I think it's they're very alive people. They sound alive, on the radio, and I love doing that. It's a great privilege for me to meet them, even on Zoom or in life. But what message do you have for those sort of listeners who really want to be like that, who want to be brave, who want to stand up for whichever thing they are? It might be the river system where they are or the forest where they are. So often it's very local, or for this bigger systemic crisis. They want to, I don't know whether it's to stop its momentum or to soften it. I don't know quite the image you'd look at.
Well, I mean, for people who are already doing things, I just say, yes, keep going, keep doing it. And for people who haven't been able to find the resolve or the courage or the headspace, heart space to be able
Yes.
to do that, that's exactly why the deep ecology workshops, the work that reconnects, is so important, because it moves us from having merely ecological ideas to having ecological identity. And once we experience ourselves as being no longer separate, you know, we've been taught that you know, humans are somehow separate, that we're just like a skin encapsulated ego, and that we can't feel the connection. Once we allow ourselves to experience that connection with the more than human world, then the tremendous motivation just surges out, and vision as to how we can engage. And Joanna talked about this being the time of the great turning away from the industrial growth society and towards a life-affirming society. And she saw three different positions that one could take in the great turning. There were the holding actions, the, you know, preventing the further destruction of forests and indigenous and languages and so on. There was the structural change, how to create the new forms, even while, you know, we're still caught in the in the dominant paradigm. This is the, you know, permaculture and eco-villages and transition towns and these things. And then finally, there was work on consciousness directly through deep ecology workshops, through meditation and so on. And what I love about that is that often you sit around a campfire with a bunch of activists and someone is like, if only everyone was doing what we were doing, what we're doing, it'd all be okay. And what Joanna says is, no, there are many different things that need to be done. And we can look at people doing things that are very different than what we're doing and understand that we're all working for the same objectives, that we're all working for the same result.
Yes, true. Now, I know, John, you have to go in a few minutes, but just one last thing. This is I've chosen to do a tribute to Joanna Macy on this program because so many people I've interviewed have spoken about her as an influence in their life. You know, when you ask them what big influences, I'd like you to just to say to listeners who might not have come across her work, just how to find her, what to look for, and how to do some of these workshops that you do.
Well, I mean, there are many people doing these workshops, especially around Melbourne. And so if you look up Joanna Macy, M-A-C-Y, you'll find tons of videos. And the videos are really good. She is such an inspiring speaker. And the other thing to look for, it's either called deep ecology or it's called the work that reconnects. And so doing a search on either of those will quickly find. And I would say that the most important thing that we can do is to make connections with like-minded, like-hearted people and then work together. I recently read a study that was conducted with a large number of participants where they asked participants a difficult question. And it was a problem that had to be solved that was so difficult that only 10% of the people were able to successfully solve the problem. But when they gave the same problem to small groups of people, 80% of the groups were able to come up with the solution. And
yeah,
we're social mammals. We weren't supposed to face these things by ourselves. We're supposed to get together with other people and work together. And that's how we're going to find the solution. So that's the really important thing, is to find people who care the way that you do and work together with them.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking to John Seed, very famous in Australia, about Joanna Macy, who's very famous, you know, really in America, but worldwide now. And good luck to you, John. Thank you very much for contributing to the show.
Thanks so much.
And now the voice of Joanna Macy, aged 93.
Well, I think that I don't have time to go into it now, but what I'm aware of is how many people are showing up now, and often kids and young people too, and then people more like my age too, that there is a deep love capacity to love our earth. See, what science is showing us, our earth is a living system. And then I'm affected by, along with that systems thinking, that deep ecology helps you live and own these larger realms of who you are and be able to be so grateful for that, that you can feel them working through you. So the preposition for this moment of human life, it seems to be through. You can be, things can work through you. The living earth, if you take a sense of identity, identified with it, can work through you so that you don't see it. It's not my power. It's not my smarts. It's not my cleverness or my devotion. It's because it comes from the living earth. You become an agent of something much vaster if you trust. So this is so incredible. And this came to me in my mid-40s, I guess, when I encountered a deep ecologist, rainforest activist in Australia named John Seed. He's still alive, but then the rest of us caught it from him, because he was defending the rainforest from illegal logging, and he was able to stand there and facing the police and the illegal loggers, knowing, he said, suddenly it changed his sense of who he was. He was the rainforest defending itself. Now, once you have that shift in identity, that you are being, that this larger identity acts through you, because the earth needs human hands. The earth needs human voices. And we're in a time when it's humans. I can talk to other humans. We're the ones who are acting like idiots.
Wondering how to pay your donations to 3CR Radiothon? It's easy. You can pay online at 3cr.org.au or call us any weekday with your credit card details on 0394198377. And be sure to tell us exactly which program you'd like your donations to go towards.
After a break, I thought I'd catch up with Dr. Peter Sainsbury. He digests many important climate and environment reports for pearls and irritations, so he can give us an overview for climate action informed by science. So welcome, Peter. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, I've been good recently.
Okay. Well, look, let's start with Sebastião Salgado. Your tribute to this Brazilian economist and photographer features a photo of two men covered in oil. Listeners, you might remember this. It was in the Gulf War, and they were trying to cap an oil well in Kuwait. It was after the war. It turns out they were Canadians. It's just these two men standing there. One's in a pool of oil. He looks beaten and ruined as oil drifts off him, and the other man's just caught in space, just caught in time, covered completely in oil, and the landscape is all oil. And I thought it symbolized our defeat in the face of a monster that we've unleashed. And how many wars have been fought over oil, and how helpless we feel with the ruin it's created, and how slow the world is to just leave it in the ground. After all, it was always in the ground until the early 20th century. And your recent articles take on several huge topics. So, but I just thought we'd start with Salgado. You're going to talk about the climate impact of war,
the need to have a new governance of water, the need for a new relationship to nature, really, and the hypocrisies and delusions that we use on the way to delay any challenge to the status quo. So tell us first about Salgado. Your image there, you know, really said a lot to me. And his photo essays were all about the dignity of people on the front lines. And many of the listeners to this program are those very same people.
Yeah, well, I came across Salgado purely by chance. I can't remember how now. But I saw that photograph that you just talked about. So I'm delighted that it said so much to you, because I've remembered it for 25 or 30 years. And it just has a quality, as you say, about the men and the setting and the reason they're there, the war over oil. But the image itself, as I said when I wrote about it, it almost looks like it's sort of Lego men or something or other, with all this shining and reflection. It's a remarkable image. Now, you know, and I'm sure that anyone who takes lots of photographs can take the odd remarkable image. But when you look at Salgado's work, it's full of images like this. He's remarkable. And in the oil fields, he's got some just terrible, I mean, wonderful photos, but terrible pictures that they portray of workers in mines in developing countries being subjected to the most terrible indignities to do their work. And then he also photographed the environment. But I agree with you about the war. In fact, I suppose most wars over the ages have been about resources, whether they're about fields or water or whatever. But in the 20th century, they've mostly been about access to power, about sources of power. I mean, oil, gas, coal, and that sort of thing. And yeah, particularly in the last 50 years, around the Middle East and so on. But equally, I mean, although there hasn't been a war, you know, the USA has waged an economic war against countries like Venezuela that have enormous reserves of oil, but don't quite play the USA's game. But yeah, it just keeps going on. And I mean, in many ways, that's what's at the root of the current conflict in the Middle East as well. It's about the USA maintaining a very, very strong and controlling influence in the Middle East through Israel. So, you know, whilst there's a lot of talk about anti-Semitism and Zionism and all the rest of it, and underneath it all, in many ways, is the role of Israel as a sort of a vassal state of the USA participating in the control of the Middle East and the Middle Eastern oil fields.
Yeah, and there is oil and gas just off the coast of Gaza, which is one element.
Indeed, there is. Exactly. That's why, you know, Donald's interested in that and Israel's interested in that. And it's not just a question of sort of pushing off out of the way all those awful people in Gaza, you know, terrible people. Get rid of them. It's not, you know, ridiculous, but it's not just about that. It's also about the resources that are just off the coast as well.
Yeah. Well, we saw it in East Timor, Australia. You know, we virtually saw a genocide there, and we sat on our hands. And then when Indonesia invaded, we signed a pact with them to share the Timor Sea oil between Australia and Indonesia. And it was a huge frontline action.
Has to be.
Yeah.
One of the low points of Australian behaviour and diplomacy, that whole business around East Timor.
Yeah,
Australia ongoing. Behaved disgracefully.
That's right.
Yeah, ongoing, quite right, yeah. Vivian, ongoing.
Yeah, and just to come back a bit to Salgado, you mentioned that you had a book of his about the polio campaigns to eradicate polio. And I looked it up and it said the world is now 99% free of polio. There are pockets of it, but 99%, that is a big achievement for public health. So I just want to keep the listeners thinking that we can solve problems. Oil was only discovered, you know, as a useful fuel in the beginning of the 20th century. So we've always had wars over resources, but that's new. And polio and many diseases have been pushed right back through the kind of science and willpower and front, and Salgado's pictures of frontline people, doctors and nurses and just community people. Tell us a bit about that. You know, that sort of big effort that the world can make. I think we should always keep it in mind that you can improve things.
Yeah, you're quite right there, of course. Younger listeners perhaps know very little about polio, but people of our generation who were perhaps just at that cusp between when polio vaccination immunization was introduced, then it was still a major issue in the 50s, just before vaccines were introduced. In fact, almost all children were exposed to polio before that time in their early childhood. And most people just either were completely unaware of it or recovered from it without any great problem whatsoever. But a small percentage, it did affect their nervous system and they became paralysed, particularly their legs. And so lots of children who got to that stage then spent the rest of their lives in calipers to support their legs. In fact, FDR, Roosevelt, had suffered from polio, so it's not just poor people or anything. But the worst in many ways was if it affected the nerves that control breathing, and then children would die, predominantly children, adults could get it, but it was predominantly children, would die because they couldn't breathe. And that, and then they invented these things called iron lungs, and to put children in that actually did the breathing for them, moved their chest in and out so that the air came in and out of their mouth and into their lungs. And a few recovered. They only needed it temporarily, but many lived in it for their whole lives. In fact, when I was training as a medical student in the early 70s, I saw people who'd been in iron lungs all their lives. But with immunisation, it's been all but eradicated. But polio is quite interesting. It's like smallpox in the sense that it only exists in human beings. So if you can stop the transmission between human beings, you can eradicate the disease. Whereas most infectious diseases don't only exist in humans. In fact, most of them come from animals, particularly new infectious diseases, HIV and the rest of them. Then it's almost impossible to eradicate them. Then it's about trying to prevent them, trying to treat them early, and so on. So you can reduce the incidence, how often they occur, but you can't necessarily eradicate them. But diseases like smallpox and polio, if you can stop the transmission between humans, which immunization is very, very good at, then you can, in principle, eradicate it. And that's what we've done with smallpox, and we've almost done it with polio.
Right.
But it was enormous effort going around all countries of the world immunizing children, and that's what Salgado documented with his photographs. And in fact, the book is actually has lots of text as well, although it's in French and my French isn't good enough to read most of it. But as I said, in places, particularly in the Horn of Africa, the immunization teams who went around the country had to be accompanied by armed guards with AK-47s to protect them from terrorist groups and so on. It's not just like being a GP surgery and sticking a needle in somewhere in somebody. It's much more difficult in some parts of the in some parts of the world. And he documented this.
And what I think Salgado documented was the kind of bravery of communities and people. Just all these women lined up, one with something being passed through a window to a woman with a baby, and just people being very resourceful. And that's what I feel we have to tap into for climate action. It's the biggest global problem that humanity's probably ever had to face, because we haven't been global for very long. You know, we haven't had that consciousness. But you've been looking at lots of different reports. And the one I thought was good, you quoted Ken Henry, and he's talked about, you know, repairing the environment if we want productivity. So, you know, go to self-interest. We want productivity. Well, you can't have it if you're degrading the environment all the time. So what new relationship with nature can environmental laws produce, do you think?
Well, first of all, just to pay tribute to Ken Henry, I've heard him speak a few times and read much of his writings, but he was treasurer of the, sorry, secretary of the treasury for Australia. And, so you might expect an economist not to be that bothered about the environment if you just caricature people. But on the absolute contrary, with Ken Henry, he's long been interested in animals and the environment. And he wrote this wonderful article in the Herald about a month ago now, making the point that protecting the environment and growing jobs are not at all contradictory. The two go together. And that if we want to build the productivity and build the collective wealth of the nation, our prosperity, then we can't continue doing it at the expense of the environment by destroying the environment, whether it be the land or the water or the air. We need to protect the environment to grow jobs and grow the economy. And to do that, we need laws that protect our environment. And at a national level, the big issue is the review that was conducted 5 years ago of the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act, which has basically just gone round in circles for the last 5 years. And the person who reviewed it, he concluded that the act was no longer fit for purpose and needed serious review. And Ken Henry was arguing that the first major test of the new Albanese government is actually to do what they promised to do in their previous term but didn't, and that's actually introduce new legislation that protects the environment and, in Ken Henry's view, then will improve the prospects for jobs and prosperity and growth of the economy. And it was a wonderful article. And I was very amused because I don't know if other people found it quite so amusing, but I found a quotation from Xi Jinping just by chance that said almost the same thing. And I suspect it might be the first time that Ken Henry has been quoted next to Xi Jinping, with the two of them being in complete agreement.
Yeah.
But in terms of so setting the legal structure is, in a sense, chicken and egg. That helps us to set the rules by which companies, governments, individuals relate to the environment. But in terms of your point about it's about our relationship with the environment, which is about values and so on. And we've come to see the environment, the nature, the world, as something we sort of sit on, that we control, that we govern, that it's been given to us for us to exploit to improve our well-being and our comfort. But we need a new relationship with nature that sees us as part of nature. That, sure, we're the most influential animal on the planet, and as such we have a responsibility. But we have to see ourselves as part of nature, in a reciprocal relationship with nature. We have to protect nature in order that we might continue to benefit from it. And in many ways, that's what Indigenous people have done for millennia. And we see that with Aboriginal people. They don't see themselves as owning the land as such, as having a custodial relationship with them, with it.
Kanderman, this is Stephen Pigram from up Broomway, Yauru country, and it's great to be down in Melbourne, and you're listening to 3CR Community Radio. Been here for a long time. Where I belong.
Thank you. Well, marine heat waves are devastating the Great Barrier Reef, and it's out of sight. Climate chaos is fueling the heat waves and turbocharging the cyclones. So what would this new environmental legislation do to protect this world heritage landscape? We love to say it's world heritage and we love to claim it, but we're not caring for it in the right way. What would legislation?
Well, very quickly, the major threat to the Great Barrier Reef is undoubtedly warmer seas that are caused by global warming, that are caused by increasing greenhouse gas emissions. Australia produces a lot of gas and coal that contribute to that. It burns it and it exports it. So it has a responsibility to reduce what we produce and burn and export. But it's a global problem, and we could play a much stronger role in trying to bring down emissions globally to zero as quickly as possible. So that's what we could do, and we should be setting our own legal targets and goals for doing that locally, but contributing internationally. But there are also things we can that are very much within our control, that a revised Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act could set laws about. And that's about runoff of the rivers from pesticides and toxins that flow into the rivers from Queensland, of course, because that's adjacent to the Barrier Reef, that are poisoning the reef. We could do much more about controlling that, and the EPBC would do that, and deforestation, reducing that again, that very strict guidelines can be set. And overfishing, where again, we could put much stronger controls if we had good, strong legislation to prevent overfishing of the Barrier Reef. So some things we need to participate in internationally, and some things that are completely within our control that the EPBC Act could help us enact much stronger regulation and monitoring, and where necessary, punishment of organisations or peoples who continue to threaten the reef.
Yeah. Well, we're talking to Dr. Peter Sainsbury, who writes for Pearls and Irritations. And I'd like to stay with water for a minute, Peter. But thinking about global water security, freshwater security, how is it connected to climate change? And what does this Global Commission of the Economics of Water report say about recognizing water as a common good?
When the population of the world was much smaller and we lived in smaller communities, then if you didn't live in somewhere like the Sahara Desert, then many people, particularly in temperate areas, Europe, North America, much of sort of Australia, certainly coastal Australia, then there was much of the time there was limitless water, and it was quite feasible to make sure that it was eminently drinkable. And so it was plenty of it, it was relatively free, it was easy to get to, and all the rest of it. And we've sort of inherited that sort of, well, it's just there, we can take it and use it and waste it, and it doesn't make much difference. And we've become conscious that that maybe isn't quite true, and that we need to be careful with the use of water and one thing and another. But what the Commission was saying is we need to not just say, well, we need to be more careful with our use of water and be aware that it's not as free and easy and abundant as we perhaps previously thought, that we live in a world where economics is important, and economics looks at how we distribute scarce resources. Now, that's not just money, it's also resources like fresh water. And so what they were arguing was, it's about looking about the whole dynamics of why water is now becoming more scarce, and how we control the whole flow, that was inadvertent, the whole progression of the production of fresh water. And it's about farming. And if we take the examples in Australia, of course, then the Murray-Darling River, which used to flow most of the time fairly freely, now it struggles because water is taken out of it upriver for irrigation, and towns further down the Murray and the Darling suffer because there isn't enough water, the environment suffers. And when the environment suffers, that destroys not just the flow in the river, but all the ecosystems, the animals and plants that live in and around the river. And it's these that are essential for our production of fresh water that we can drink and use for other purposes, for washing and keeping clean and hygiene, which is important for the prevention of diseases like polio. And they're saying we have to see it as a scarce resource that we manage carefully and look at it in that way, and see in effect in a capitalist system, what are the economic drivers of the preservation of well, of the production of fresh water that we can drink, of its conservation, of its distribution and so on, that we need to do all those sorts of things and not just see it as something that's free and abundant and anyone can get to. And the report made some really interesting comments that that I think it was, what is it, I worked it out that there are the women and girls around the world who have to walk and collect water in buckets or barrels or whatever and take it home. That would be the equivalent every day of basically every adult Australian spending 11 hours a day carting water around. I mean, it's just remarkable that that's the case. And many children under five die because of the lack of availability of clean water and sanitation and so on. And that we need to look at the economics of how we distribute water to people who haven't got it, how we set up sewage systems so that children don't die because they're living in dirty circumstances. So it was making those points. And this needs not just local government or state water authorities to be looking after the drains and pipes and reservoirs, but it needs a whole global approach, with local attention, of course, but that water is distributed globally, not just locally.
Yeah. Well, a local example is the Mataranka water allocation in the Northern Territory, where you notice that the Northern Territory Environment Centre is having a legal action against that allocation of the Roper River water. We've all heard about Roper River. It's a very big water system up there, and not enough is getting to the environment. It seems to me it has to be through law, you know, people taking you to court, or absolute public protest and demonstrations. And I know there are demonstrations over the Beetaloo Basin gas up there. It comes down to that, doesn't it? You have to protest and push back all the time. Do you want to tell us just a tiny bit about that, Roper River?
Well, Mataranka is a great example. I agree. I hadn't thought of tying the two together there. Well done. But yeah, I couldn't believe it when I read about Mataranka, that approval has been given by the Northern Territory government for irrigators, cotton and various other crops, to take, well, I've got it here, so I can't remember what it was. Do you remember what it was? I've got it here. 62,000 megalitres of water every year for cotton, hay, melons and mangoes. But for the environment, the water from these springs, it was only 30 megalitres. I thought that must have been a misprint. I thought it must have been 30,000 megalitres. So I actually followed up and checked. And no, that's correct. So it's about 2,000 times as much water is being allocated to irrigators as to the environment from these wonderful springs. If you see the photographs, I encourage people to just Google Mataranka Springs. And they're so important both for the environment and for humans, for recreation, and they maintain the ecosystems around them. But they'll be destroyed, there's no doubt about it, if we just keep taking water out for basically growing crops like cotton in a completely inappropriate place. We shouldn't be growing cotton in the Northern Territory and taking water out of aquifers and so on and springs. It's ridiculous. And laws and proper review of proposals to do that sort of thing and getting governments out of the sort of pockets of irrigators and miners and one sort or another. That's what we need laws to do in the first place, and then that allow communities to challenge when they think bad decisions have been made.
3CR is radical radio, and that means more than just alternative current affairs and political coverage.
We're radical because we're an independent media outlet owned and operated by the community.
We're radical because we give communities the control of their own shows with their own music in their own languages.
We're radical because we provide a media platform for communities to build their own power to create social change.
Become a subscriber and support Radical Radio. Call us on 03 9419 8377 or subscribe online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Now, I'd like to take it up a notch a bit to something very global and talk about peace. I was very impressed last week myself. I don't know if you've read this one yet, but it's a report by Francesca Albanese on how corporations profit from genocide. She's trying to put the guilt on the companies that actually they seem to be innocently supplying tractors and earth-moving equipment and so on, but if they're used to destroy settlements, you know, people's livelihoods, and eventually genocide. She names names and shows how, for example, Swiss company Glencore exports coal to Israel for the electricity that now Israel is withholding from hospitals, water pumps, and energy. One result of that takes us right back to Salgado and the polio, because the sewage outfall in Gaza is apparently causing a resurgence of polio. I think a report could just as easily be put together showing corporations profiting from ecocide.
Oh, and big ag, big agriculture.
Yeah. The recent NATO report you looked into said that we're going to have a huge increase in spending. So that's a huge increase in emissions. And to me, it's an increase in ecocide as well as, you know, a huge death among people who are impacted by the climate effect of ongoing war. So what do you think a report like Albanese's report that focused, for example, on Lockheed and Boeing and Northrop Grumman, not only for crimes against humanity, but crimes against nature, and what would it say to their shareholders, a report like that, talking to the shareholders of those companies?
Well, you're spot on. I mean, I'm not sure what else I can say, to be honest with you, Vivian. I think you've expressed it very well. You're absolutely right. The basis, just going back a fraction for listeners, is that the NATO countries, not Australia at this stage, of course, because we're not in NATO, but they've agreed to increase their allocation of money to their defence forces. I'm not sure that defence is quite the right word. From what was less than 2% for most of them a few years ago to 3.5% and then 5% of their GDP by 2035. And this means, of course, more equipment, they'll have more munitions, they'll be consuming more fossil fuels because they're still very heavily dependent on fossil fuels. The burning of oil by fighter jets is incredible, phenomenal. And you're right, that will increase global warming, but they also destroy the environment. And in fact, where wars have been fought in Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and so on, then the environment still suffers from Agent Orange and the burning of the environments and landmines that are still in the ground and so on. And basically, that's what's being funded by this increase. You know, it's presented as, oh, well, we need to spend 5% in our defence against all these nasty Russians and Chinese and terrorists and one thing and another. But the outcome is that it makes people unsafe rather than safe. It destroys the environment. It increases global warming. And I think I've worked out that that 5% of NATO countries' GDP is actually more than Russia's complete total GDP. So, I mean, Russia is nowhere near competing at a military level with NATO. Their whole budget's less than this 5%. But yes, it's ridiculous, really, that we spend so much money on military defence and so little on diplomacy and better international relations to actually prevent the problems in the first place. But the beneficiaries, as you point out, of all of this are basically not the Chinese or the Russians or the Americans or the Europeans or those in common people. The real beneficiary are the arms manufacturers. They sell their arms to all these navies and air forces and armies and one thing and another, and they love a war. Because A, it gets them to test their equipment, and B, it gets used so the militaries have to buy more. You know, these companies, they just love a war. The companies, in many ways, are more powerful than the fossil fuel industries in government. And government and fossil fuel executives rotate back and forth in arms manufacturers just as much as they do in fossil fuel. You know, people will have heard people talk about the military-industrial complex. Well, it's really a government military-industrial complex in places like the USA and Australia.
Oh, well, just to finish, Peter, I want to talk just something I think positive. Next year is the United Nations Year of Rangelands and Pastoralists, and you wrote an article about grasslands, saying that grasslands should be our heroes. Can you finish with that? And also just give a shout out to the activists who listen to this program. You know, where should they be putting their energies?
Well, I think there are many areas that tend to be forgotten, and grasslands are one, peatlands are another, and I think waterways, the oceans, are tend to be forgotten, and yet they are enormously important in controlling the global ecosystem. Grasslands and peatlands actually hold a lot more carbon than forests, but forests are the sort of pin-up boys and girls. In fact, you'll be able to see, the listeners won't, but I've actually got a t-shirt on at the moment that says protect native forests, not protect native peatlands or grasslands. But again, we've destroyed so much of the grasslands, and the consequence of that is, of course, in somewhere like Africa, we've actually destroyed lots of the big herds of herbivores, and then that flows through to the carnivores, the big cats and so on, if there's not the same supply of herbivores for them to hunt on as they've traditionally done. But we've also destroyed the traditional lands for agriculture and hunting of the indigenous peoples of Africa and so on. And so, yeah, I like to sort of highlight what I think are forgotten areas a bit that have enormous potential to contribute to a healthier environment and a healthier world, a healthier human beings. And grasslands undoubtedly fall into that. So when I talk about grasslands, we're talking about, say, the pampas of South America, the savannas of Africa, the steppes of Russia, the Great Plains of North America, and indeed lots of the sort of across northern Australia where there are enormous grasslands. So those are the things that we're talking about protecting those areas. I mean, I'm, you know, very pessimistic about governments taking adequate action to tackle all of these problems: biodiversity, grasslands, climate change, and one thing and another. And I think they'll continue to be slow to do it. But I think it is up to activists, people like us and others in different ways. People are active in different ways. Is, whilst we say, look, I am expecting things to get worse, then, but we've got to keep pushing. We've got to keep being active. We've got to keep pushing governments to do better. We've got to keep electing people to parliament and into government who we don't need to persuade what needs doing, but they're going in there agreeing with us already about what needs doing. And we need to, you know, demonstrate peacefully, but at times inconveniently for people. I'm not opposed to obstructing and blocking things and peaceful sort of direct action. We need to be writing to companies. We need to be attending annual general meetings of companies and asking questions and making ourselves unwanted, so to speak. There are lots of ways people can be active, because we have to see that at some point things are going to change, because things are going to get so bad that they absolutely have to change. And what we need to do as activists is get us to that point as soon as possible, such that the damage that's been done is not completely irreversible. We need to keep pushing our governments, keep pushing companies to behave better. And that takes us back to the EPBC Act and how important legislation is in all of this, and how important people like us are in pushing governments to enact strong legislation.
Yeah. Many thanks, Peter. That's excellent overview. And I hope the listeners read your articles in Pearls and Irritations. We've been speaking to Dr. Peter Sainsbury, and he's a great nature lover and always out there in the bush. I'm sure you know those grasslands quite well and countryside much more than I do. But thank you very much for talking to us today.
My pleasure. Actually, I'm going out to Western New South Wales in a couple of weeks, and we're going to visit properties between Broken Hill and the Murray Darling, some properties, conservation properties, see what they look out like out there.
Good on you. Thank you very much.
Okay, good to talk to you, Vivian.
Thank you.
Every year, Wildlife Victoria receives tens of thousands of calls reporting sick, injured, or orphaned wildlife. The biggest reason? Road accidents. If you're driving and hit a native animal or see an animal injured by the side of the road, call Wildlife Victoria's Emergency Response Service on 03 84 00 7300. And remember to slow down, especially between dusk and dawn. Wildlife Victoria is a 3CR supporter.
Thanks for listening to the Climate Action Show, dear listeners. I'd like to thank John Seed, whose book Thinking Like a Mountain is a great inspiration, and Joanna Macy, whose book Active Hope is really a guide for climate action groups. Thanks to Theodora Gooden, who told me that Joanna Macy had died, and Peter Sainsbury, whose tribute to Sebastián Salgado got me started again. A big thanks to Michaela, Inez, Karina, Rosie, Bella, Marion, plus Ducky and Angus, who have got the show to air while I was on sick leave. Love to you all. My name is Vivian Langford. Goodbye and good luck.
This is coal. Don't be afraid.
The
Don't
treasurer.
Be scared. It's coal. It's coal.
Tune in every Monday at 5 p.m. to hear the Climate Action Radio Show.
Thank you.